From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Today, the House will decide whether to impeach President Donald Trump for a second time. Lawmakers are considering one article of impeachment for inciting violence against the government after last week's deadly riot by pro-Trump extremists. That followed the president's address in which he said, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." Democrats have the votes to impeach him, and a handful of Republicans are joining them, but not our next guest. Congressman John Curtis, Republican of Utah, released a video this week in which he agonized over how to vote. He told us earlier today why he finally decided to vote no.
The whole problem I have with this is the timing. We don't have any chance to think this through. And so that is forcing me to a no vote. I don't understand the rush.
Well, and you mentioned in your video that you had some real reservations about not affording the president enough due process, which is what I take you to mean when you say that we're rushing things. But I have to point out that a vote to impeach is not a vote to convict, though. I mean, the president would still have his chance to defend himself and make his case in a Senate trial. Some would say that is due process.
If you look at the last two impeachments, the Senate has not taken up any evidence that wasn't presented in the House. So technically, you're right. That would be the president's venue. But based on tradition, that's not the case. We all remember that the Senate didn't call witnesses in President Trump's first impeachment. And the precedent is whatever we do here in the House becomes what they use to make their decision.
So you're looking to precedent there. I also imagine you're looking for other ways in which your decision might set a new precedent. And so on the other side, you know, the text of this article of impeachment includes quotes from the president's speech, which we mentioned at the top. He falsely claims to have won the election in a landslide. And he says things like he wants his supporters to fight like hell. So, I mean, if you don't impeach him for this, do you worry about setting that precedent, you know, where another president could do something like this and go unchecked?
Let me just put an asterisk here. I'm not defending the president, but conveniently left out of all of this is the quote that he said, "Let's do this peaceably." Basically, what's happening is we're saying this speech caused the riots. We don't have time to know that. This would fail in a court of law. I just want to reiterate, I don't want people to assume from this that the president doesn't have some accountability here. That's not what I'm saying at all. But we know these protesters came to D.C. This was premeditated. They came with the equipment to do what they did. They came with the plan to do what they did. So,
but isn't it possible also, Congressman, that they came and hadn't made up their minds about whether they would follow through and that they took the president's speech as kind of a green light? That was their permission to carry out what they had premeditated.
You've just made my point. We need to take the time to know that. Why? Give me a single reason for the rush.
So in the meantime, then, you've called for censuring the president, and I think a lot of folks are wondering, what would that do? They're wondering the same thing about impeachment, because after all, he is leaving office anyway in a very short period of time.
Can you give me a single reason for the rush?
Well, I think that
the
Democrats have put forward is to act now because they want to start the process before he leaves office. And the key difference, as you know, between an impeachment process and a censure is that with impeachment, the Senate could vote later, it would be a separate vote, to disqualify him from holding federal office in the future. That's a big distinction. So what do you make of that?
All of that could, why not take 100 days in the House? If you're going to give the Senate 100 days, why aren't you taking 100 days in the House? Listen, I agree. There are some very disturbing things about what happened. Why do the bedrock of the American judicial system are fundamental things like innocent until proven guilty and a trial by an impartial jury and an opportunity to defend yourself. Let's slow down. Let's give people like myself who are willing to hold the president accountable. Let's give us a chance to see all of the facts. The facts might be a lot more damning for the president than what we have in front of us now.
Fair enough, although I will point out that the impeachment process, of course, although somewhat analogous to a court of law, is somewhat different. I mean, we did hear the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, explicitly saying last time that this really is a political process and that he is not an impartial juror in the way that you would be in a court of law. So there are some key differences there. And while I'm talking about McConnell, Congressman, I know he's in the other chamber, but the New York Times is reporting that he privately supports impeaching the president because he believes he did commit impeachable offenses and also thinks that the upside for his party is that, you know, if they did vote to bar him from future office, it would be a way to sort of, you know, purge the party from the president and start with a clean slate in 2024. What do you make of that line of thinking?
Well, I don't see how purging the party is an impeachable goal. That's ridiculous. And if Mitch McConnell feels that way, let him say it.
And what about the leaders in your own chamber, Congressman? His House, your party's leader, Kevin McCarthy, giving you all guidance on how to vote this way? Or are you all sort of being left to sort of make your own calls on this?
It's very clear that we're to make a decision on our own hearts, our own beliefs, and there's been zero pressure to vote one way or another.
All right. That's Congressman John Curtis, Republican of Utah. Congressman, thank you for joining us. As you know, not everybody in your caucus is willing to come forward and answer questions about this, so we appreciate your time.
Happy to do it. Thanks. You have a good day.
With Congress on the brink of history, calls are growing for two Republican senators to resign for their role in fanning the flames of last week's insurrection. Elsewhere on the program, we'll hear about the local response to Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. But first to Texas, where at least two major newspapers have blasted Senator Ted Cruz for amplifying false claims of election fraud that inspired the rioters. Lisa Falkenberg is editor of opinion for the Houston Chronicle. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And your editorial says, "Resign, Senator Cruz, your lies cost lives. Make the case for his resignation."
Well, the interesting thing about these debates is right now we're in a situation where the temperature's gotten turned up so high that people are calling for Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley to be added to the no-fly list, and some are calling them terrorists. That was not the point in our editorial. Our editorial was that for months, Ted Cruz was leading the way in helping perpetuate the false narrative of President Trump that there had been widespread election fraud, that the election was stolen from Trump. I remember watching Sean Hannity's show a few days after the election and just watching in disbelief as Ted Cruz on national TV lied about, for instance, the Pennsylvania count, saying that it was done in the shroud, under the shroud of darkness. Meanwhile, it was being live streamed on YouTube. So my concern isn't that he was calling on people to do violence. It's that his lies helped create the atmosphere, add to the anger and the vitriol, and then all the president had to do was throw a match on it.
So Ted Cruz has spoken out against that violence. He expressed his sympathies to the family of the Capitol police officer who died. He claims he has nothing to do with inciting the riot. And he's made it clear that he's not planning on going anywhere. Does your paper support removing him from office through the 14th Amendment if he doesn't resign?
I think that what we support is for him to do the right thing. And this was a call on him to be a representative who's responsible and to apologize for what he's done. I think that would make more difference than anything. And he's refused to do that. So at this point, voters are left to take notes, remember what's going on, and make sure they hold him accountable at the ballot box.
The evolution of Ted Cruz is worth pointing out. There are inconsistencies in his record, to say the least. Now he's defending Trump's false election fraud claims, as you laid out. But here he is back in 2016 when he was running against the president.
This man is a pathological liar. He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth. And in a pattern that I think is straight out of a psychology textbook, his response is to accuse everybody else of lying.
What do you think changed for
Ted
Cruz?
Are we talking about Ted Cruz there? Are we talking about Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, I take your point. How do you think he became such a defender of the president after that?
You know, that's the interesting thing. When somebody insults your wife and accuses your father of having a part in JFK's assassination, you'd think that things like that would leave an effect and force you not to, at least not to pander to the person who said those words later. But politics is politics, actually. Moving on and trying to get things done and trying to work with the president, I don't begrudge anybody for doing that. But actually taking part in the very words and the very things that he's accusing the president of doing is what is remarkable. But maybe, hey, maybe it's not remarkable. Maybe Ted Cruz is able to do these things because he is a lot more like Donald Trump than he would like to admit.
You've been getting a lot of response to this editorial, I'm sure. You're in a conservative state. Ted Cruz won his last election in 2018. It was close, but he won. How do you think voters will respond to this? Will they have forgotten about it by the time he runs again in 2024?
So he still has a lot of support, of course, but the love for him is much less than the condemnation, the disgust. So, of course, we've gotten people canceling their subscriptions. We've gotten many more subscriptions. It really wasn't about subscriptions. It was about, you know, this is the right call at the right time.
Lisa Falkenberg, editor of Opinion for the Houston Chronicle, talking about an editorial calling on Senator Ted Cruz to resign. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Every few years, I like to reach into the old archive and pull out this next story. It's about gazing up at the stars in Yellowstone National Park. And considering the state of the world, I think we could benefit from a deep breath right now. Some wonderment and joy derived from this magnificent yet violent universe that we live in. This story first aired in 2016 when we spent a few nights reporting in Yellowstone to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. On one of those nights, I crossed the Fire Hole River with park rangers Tammy Corchero and Rebecca Rowland. They took me across a bridge with a single flashlight that was no match for the darkness.
Are we going to, like, step off this thing at any point accidentally?
No. No, we don't want to do that.
Okay. There's, see, there's railings all the way up.
Now, if the sun were shining, we'd have seen a kaleidoscope of blues and reds and yellows that ring the famous Excelsior Geyser and the Grand Prismatic Spring. But at night, from this vantage point, you couldn't really see anything. You could only hear.
That's the runoff from Excelsior Geyser, pouring out of a geyser crater into the Firehole River.
And the steam is lifting up off the ground and kind of blending in with the Milky Way.
Yes. So we're going to go up a little farther on the boardwalk because it's really cool to see the Milky Way from up top here.
And the Milky Way is why we came. The rangers led me through the rising steam to a spot on the boardwalk where at once the whole galaxy bursts into view. Turns out, you can see something in Yellowstone at night. Tammy Corchero is a park ranger whose specialty is stars.
The night sky out here is overwhelming, especially for folks that have never seen a sky like this. It's amazing. It's like we're completely surrounded here by the universe, wouldn't you say?
You can see the Milky Way maybe as clear as I have ever seen the Milky Way before.
Awesome. Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that because about a third of the population of the world can't see the Milky Way anymore. And that includes about 80% of the population of North America. So we now have whole generations of people here in the United States who have never seen the Milky Way. Huh. And so that's, you know, one reason why it's so important to protect dark skies like this. It makes me kind of sad to think that there are people that might go through their whole life and never experience something like this. You know, there actually was an astronomer who worked for the U.S. Naval Observatory. His name was Jeff Chester, and he said the night sky is the world's largest national park with its stark beauty available to anyone who steps outside and looks up.
I can see a satellite moving across the sky there. What else do you see?
Sometimes when you sit under a dark sky like this, there's so many stars, and it is really exceptionally clear tonight. There's so many stars that you almost can't even recognize the constellations that you do know.
There's the Big Dipper.
We see the Big Dipper, okay? And the Big Dipper is not actually a constellation. It's
what?
No. It's an
astrology. You're blowing my mind here. What are you saying the Big Dipper is not
a constellation? It's not a constellation. It's actually an asterism. And an asterism is a highly recognizable part of a constellation.
Time out. Stop. What are you doing right now?
So this is a really cool tool that astronomers, and I'm not an astronomer, but I love to share the night sky with people. So I don't know how they did it before this.
You are lightsabering.
Isn't it cool?
Outer space.
I wish that Rebecca had one too.
I love this thing. What is this? What's it called?
It's a laser pointer, and these
No, but it's not a normal laser pointer.
It is.
Well, it's a pretty high-powered laser pointer.
Can I just run my finger through it?
Yeah, I think you'll be okay.
Whoa! Oh, my God. Oh, that was so weird.
Cool.
A giant green light just came off my fingernail. No.
Oh, my gosh.
I never have.
We use them at Carlsbad Caverns.
I feel like a small child or something.
Yeah. These are awesome. So they help us to, you know, point out distinct things in the night sky. So the Big Dipper is a part of the constellation Ursa Major.
Oh, that's right. We were talking about the Big Dipper.
Right. Okay. So the Great Bear, and so the Dipper part of it, that's his body, and then the handle, that's his tail. One really cool thing about the Big Dipper is that it helps us to orient ourselves at night. So if you follow these front two stars here...
Can I see if I remember my middle school astronomy
class? Yes, definitely.
If you follow
awesome.
Those front two stars, yep. Is it going to point me to the North Star?
Yes, Polaris, that star right there.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that awesome?
And so you just found that star out of the middle of a sea of stars.
I've been out here a few times. So this star, Polaris, is a relatively stationary star, at least how it appears to us. And the reason why it's stationary is because it lies directly above the Earth's axis of rotation. So if you took a line and you drew it from the South Pole through the center of the Earth, through the North Pole, and extended it out into space, it would eventually intersect with Polaris.
Huh.
Now, an interesting thing about Polaris is that it hasn't always been and it will not always be the North Star, because there's enough wobble in the Earth's rotation on its axis that over time our view of the stars changes. So in about 2,000 years, let me see if I can find it. There's a lot of stars out there tonight. Huh. This star right here, Arai, will become the North Star. So sometime around the year 4100. Okay, here's another cool star. Can you see that red star right there?
Let's see.
So I'm kind of pointing. I'll take the laser
pointer.
Yeah,
I mean, I can, but I would never have guessed that that was red unless you told me.
Right. You kind of have to know what you're looking at. That's called the Garnet Star, and it's part of this constellation Cepheus. That's believed to be one of the reddest stars in the sky, and it's also one of the biggest stars in the sky. That's actually a red supergiant star. I'll show you another one here in Scorpius that's, you know, looks more like a supergiant star. That star, let me find it again, right here, is almost 900 million miles in diameter.
And yet it looks like a tiny
little prick of light. It's a tiny dot. You would never find that star if I hadn't pointed it out to you.
I don't know how you did it.
Well, because I know where it is.
Are you lying to me?
No, I'm not making... Well, I could totally make stuff up out here, couldn't I?
Oh my gosh, did you just see that shooting star?
Yeah. No, I was looking over here this way.
So, where we're standing right now, and if the sun were up and it were the middle of the day, there would be hundreds, maybe thousands of people here in the middle of the summer, right?
Oh,
right,
yes.
Now, we are absolutely by ourselves.
Awesome.
How does the park change for you when the sun goes down?
Well, it provides us, or it provides me, but all of us, access to this whole other half of Yellowstone. And because this park has recognized the value of dark night skies, we are working to protect it. The park does not allow any outdoor lighting outside of develop areas. So no lights on the roads, no lights on the trails, no lights in the backcountry on structures like patrol cabins. And that's to preserve the quality of this wilderness setting that we have here in Yellowstone. And this dark, pristine, amazing sky that we have here tonight is very much a part of that wilderness setting.
Even with those protections, do you feel like the sky is threatened?
Yes. The sky is always threatened because there's, you know, there's no guarantee that protections will always be in place. Things change, right? And as I said earlier, You know, a third of the world cannot see the Milky Way anymore. It's actually estimated that light pollution is going to continue to increase at a rate of about 6% per year. And so by the end of this century, no one in the developed world will have dark night skies unless areas are protected. And so right now, one of the things Yellowstone is doing is trying to qualify or get designated as a dark sky park. In 2015, I think there were 19 dark sky parks around the world, state parks, national parks, and other protected areas. One of the qualifications is that 67%, or about two-thirds, of outdoor lights in your park need to be what we call fully shielded, which means the only light that you see is coming down.
It points down. There's a cover on top of it that prevents it from going up.
Prevents it from going up and also prevents it from going out to the sides. We have more than 5,000 outdoor lights in this park. That's a big job.
As we speak, I'm seeing another example of light pollution, and it's right over that ridge. The Maple Fire is burning, and you can see it coming up over the mountain in the darkness. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, yes. And that's natural light pollution.
We can live with that.
Yeah, we can. And the moon, you know, you only get stars or skies like this when you don't have the moon out, right? And the moon will come up here in a little while.
Well, Tammy Corchero, we've been speaking for all this time in the darkness. I haven't even seen your face.
but look at what you have been seeing. I mean, come on.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be out here with you tonight.
That story first aired after my trip to Yellowstone National Park in 2016. And an update, Yellowstone is now a dark sky park. All right, back to facing life on Earth in 2021.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
As we reported last week, the U.S. economy lost jobs in December for the first time in 8 months, 140,000 to be exact, according to the Labor Department. And now there's a startling new analysis from the National Women's Law Center. And here's the headline. All of the jobs lost in December were women's jobs. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, for more on what this could mean for women in the workforce. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm well. What stands out to you in this analysis from the National Women's Law Center?
What was really alarming for me was this creeping sense of capitulation, that an economic shock turned into a chronic new normal for millions of women. In December, about 40% of women aged 20 and over had been out of work for 6 months or more. By autumn, we saw that 6 months into the pandemic, one in four women said they were considering downshifting their careers or leaving the workforce outright.
It's alarming. And just to make a clarification, in case there's a man out there who's listening and saying, hey, I lost my job in December, this doesn't mean that every single person who got laid off last month was a woman. But on the net, men actually gained 16,000 jobs in December, while women lost 156,000. So when the Labor Department says there were 140,000 jobs lost overall, women account for that entire total, Robin. I mean, what does that say to you?
I mean, I think that just the longer that this persists, if you step back from it, the more rungs it's kicking out from this ladder that women have been trying to climb for so many decades. Women age 20 and over, Calum, they've had an unemployment rate of 6.3%, according to that report, which is nearly twice as high as it was to start 2020. You're already trying to scale this ladder at lower pay. I think it's 18% on average across the board. And so coming out of this, you lose wage clout that took years to accumulate. as you're seeking to re-enter the workforce, especially in lower-paying service sector jobs?
Well, I think that 18% figure you tossed out, another way we often phrase that is that women working full-time are paid 82 cents for every dollar paid to men. And it's worth pointing out that this is not the same across the board. In fact, the situation is even more dire for Black and Latino women. So what could last year's job losses mean for the gender and racial wage gap in the years to come?
Think of all the restaurant, table, kitchen, hotel service jobs, flight attendants. How many countless janitors aren't being asked to show up at these empty office buildings? There is, of course, a chance, maybe even a good one, that things truly roar back in travel, hospitality, and leisure. But many of these jobs will have been shed for good structurally. The job descriptions are going to change, require more automation. I mean, the casual restaurant that you frequented with your family before the pandemic, the chain, chances are it has a tablet at your table. Help yourself. Swipe your own card. There's going to be a real cold wind that blows out of this economic crisis coming out of it.
You know, Robin, as you and I, two men, talk about these women's job numbers, I think something for men to reflect on is this reality that as domestic responsibilities have increased during the pandemic, by and large, it's been women who have shouldered those extra responsibilities and made the professional sacrifices.
And let me mansplain some humility here. This speaks to how much we all were winging it when everything changed overnight with childcare responsibilities. Overwhelmingly, homeschooling and childcare duties default to women. It was in practice rare to see peer tag team parenting while both employers' demands were being met. Childcare, we're realizing, is not an optional side gig, something you can just toggle in and out of and wing. It is itself a full-time job whose uncertainty imperils the entire economy. And I think that lesson really has to be internalized.
Something for us all to do better in 2021. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
As COVID-19 cases continue to rise in the U.S., vaccination efforts are ramping up too. And on Tuesday, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar unveiled some major changes. More seniors are now eligible, as are people with one high-risk medical condition. Let's bring in Helen Branswell from our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Helen, you know, we've been reporting on the show about vaccine prioritization, and we heard the CDC say last month that states should put healthcare workers at the front of the line. So what does this expansion of the priority list mean?
Healthcare workers are still at the very front of the line. What Secretary Azar announced yesterday was a new prioritization for Phase 1B. As you mentioned, he announced that the new Phase 1B should include this very large group of people over 65.
So what's the reason for the change? It's quite ambitious.
Everybody's quite frustrated at how slow the rollout has been. The vaccine rollout started just before the Christmas holidays. There wasn't that much vaccine to administer. What Secretary Azar was saying yesterday was, you know, speed things up, get more people in line. It's not clear that putting more people in line is going to speed things up, however.
So, Helen, scaling up in this way also means expanding the number of places where people can go to be vaccinated. That's one important piece of inoculating 152 million people, which is now the number of people at the front of the line. But another critical piece of this is making sure we have enough doses for that number of people. I mean, do we or will we soon?
Yeah, that is the $64 trillion question. No, is the short answer. You know, yesterday, Secretary Azar said as of yesterday, a total of 38 million doses had been available for the states to order against. But the flow of vaccine, they now say they feel confident that they're going to have enough coming in. But HHS says they don't expect to have distributed more than 200 million doses by the end of March. You know, those 152 million people that you just mentioned each need two doses of these vaccines. You know, when you look at it that way, it looks like the first two priority groups are going to take into April before they finish vaccinating those groups.
Yeah, just doing the quick math as the numbers you laid out, that would leave about 50 million of that 152 million people short unless they're able to ramp up production. So going forward, Helen, you know, how are these going to change the way that these doses are allocated to the states?
So that's not clear. I mean, one of the things that Secretary Azar said yesterday was that states that were moving through their doses quickly would actually get more doses, and states that were moving more slowly would see their allocations drop as a consequence. But the thing is, he said this new policy would go into effect in 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, Secretary Azar will not be at the head of HHS. So it's not clear that this is a policy that is actually going to go into effect.
Well, that's a great point, because there is this sort of continuity question because a new administration is coming in the near future. And I know that you've spoke with some experts, Helen, who are concerned about this change to priority groups, how workable it is. I mean, is that the root of their concern, this continuity issue, or is there some other underlying problem that they foresee?
Some of them are concerned about the fact that this bumps back essential frontline workers. And you could end up with somebody who's fairly young and has one health condition getting vaccinated before somebody who's 85. And it will raise questions of fairness, for sure.
Well, last thing, Helen, as you mentioned, people trying to find doses, I'm sure that folks listening, if they're checking and saying, oh, I now fall into this priority group, and they may be wondering, does that mean I can now go out today or tomorrow and suddenly get a vaccine that I couldn't get yesterday? So can they? How quickly will these changes go into effect?
I think that will depend on, you know, the states, whether they've done enough of their phase 1A to feel like that they can move on. There's a lot of variability from place to place.
So lots to follow with this rollout, and no uniform answers necessarily across the whole country, which will keep you plenty busy, Helen. That's Helen Branswell with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Helen, thanks as always for your time.
Nice to talk to you.
In San Diego, at least two gorillas have tested positive for COVID-19, and others are showing symptoms. This is the first known natural spread of the virus to great apes. The park closed its doors to the public in early December to stop the spread of disease, and it's monitoring the health of the other gorillas in the troop. We're joined now by Executive Director of the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, Lisa Peterson. Lisa, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be here.
First of all, how are these apes doing? How sick are they?
They're actually doing pretty well. Wildlife tends to be relatively resilient. And so the subtle behavior changes that we've seen is maybe a bit of lethargy, so maybe not quite as active as they usually are, but they are eating, drinking, taking in all the their diet that's prepared for them every day. So it's more about lethargy, a little bit of a cough, and some runny noses in a few cases.
I see. Well, as I mentioned, the zoo has been closed to the public. So what do we know about how these gorillas got sick? How'd they get the virus in the first place?
So our team dresses at the park. Their uniforms are kept separate from the clothes they arrive in. They're showering before they leave. They wear gloves. They wear masks. So there's a pretty strong and solid protocol in place already. What we've done now, because we had an asymptomatic team member who tested positive, and so as soon as that happened, that triggered our watch of the gorillas. We wanted to make sure that we understood what was happening. Timing is important, as it is for anybody who is fighting this illness. And so at that point, we then stepped up our biosecurity once we knew that the gorillas had tested positive. So now we are doing eye coverings as well as their masks. They'll continue with gloves, and now they're wearing over their clothes, they're wearing like a Tyvek type thing, so that can be disposed of when at the end of their workday.
Sure. So the assumption is that one of your employees who was asymptomatic spread the virus to the animal, despite these really tough precautions that you were taking. As you say, they were wearing disposable aprons and clothes and gloves and masks. Does it concern you that the virus made that jump?
It's very concerning because we're seeing it among human population, and it's tricky, it's evolving, and the situation is evolving. So yes, it is concerning that this happened, but I don't think it's unlike what we're seeing in, you know, across the nation. Certainly here in California, we're still really struggling with the illness and getting it into a more manageable place. So there is concern, but at the same time, we're continuing to care for them, and we'll continue to update our protocols and our guidelines as we see fit to ensure that we are doing the utmost we can to protect them and to also protect our team. That's my responsibility, is to look after both.
Humans share 98% of our DNA with gorillas. Do we know yet if the virus is as dangerous for those apes as it is for some humans?
I'm not a veterinarian, but what I can say is that I think there's certain risk that is comparable to our risk. But the thing that's different about wildlife is that they, if they are not in our care and maybe in their natural range, there are some immunities. There is some resiliency in animals because there isn't an opportunity for them to be cared for. So we are not seeing it as bad as it, maybe it could be if you compared it to a human being.
There have been other cases of tigers and lions getting sick with COVID. But really, this story is more than just a curiosity, because a virus moving between species can be a pretty big deal in terms of public safety. I mean, that's how this pandemic started in the first place. So what are the possible consequences of a virus jumping back and forth between a species like this?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is really this concept of one health. And so what happens to wildlife and natural habitats, plants and animals, and human beings, we're all tied together. And I hope that this is a wake-up call for folks that conservation matters, that by protecting animals, places, and plants, we are in fact protecting ourselves.
And just briefly, do you expect that at some point these gorillas could get vaccinated against the virus?
We would obviously love for that to happen. But I think given where we are as a nation, specifically here in California, and how hard we're being hit by the virus, I would say we need to focus on the human population and getting our human folks to get vaccinated first, and really make sure that we get this under control in our communities. That's really the best way to help everyone.
Interesting to note that the animals could be vaccinated. That's Lisa Peterson, Executive Director of the San Diego Zoo Safari Park. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
In the heart of Southeast Dallas, a huge pile of toxic waste looms over a community. It's a mound of shingles stacked so high it's earned the nickname Shingle Mountain. The fight to get rid of it took almost 3 years, and now the city of Dallas has hired a company to haul it away. That process is underway. Alejandra Martinez from member station KERA has the story of how Shingle Mountain came to be through the eyes of the people who had to live in its shadow.
More than a decade ago, Cecilia del Toro Garcia moved with her husband to the community of Floral Farms in Southeast Dallas. They dreamed of their granddaughters growing up with lots of green space all around. Little did they know, they'd get a monstrous neighbor in 2018.
Te presento la montaña.
I present to you Shingle Mountain, Garcia says. She walks around her backyard. There are stables, roaming goats, even a bull. And just behind them stands the massive toxic dump, which she says has killed her motivation.
Me la paso enredo de la cama. Nomás acostada viendo televisión. Pensando en los problemas que hay. Eso de que, ¿cuándo van a quitar esa montaña? Y si mis hijas van a estar saludables.
Even though Shingle Mountain has finally started coming down, Garcia used to question if it ever would. She also worries if her family will be healthy even after the mountain's gone. It was 2018 when Blue Star Recycling bought the property and started stacking up piles of roofing materials next to Garcia's home. That's when she says the air changed.
Ya cuando empezamos a notar que los carros tenían polvo negro arriba.
Garcia says black dust now covers everything around her home, and her nose bleeds a lot. Her next-door neighbor, Marcia Jackson, has her own set of health problems.
The headaches are just crazy, and all this ground-up shingles is blowing. So when it blows, that fiberglass is going off into my throat, and the fiberglass has just irritate my vocal cords.
Jackson is the neighborhood's number one advocate, a resident-turned-environmental activist, because she had to. She started calling the city of Dallas almost 3 years ago, asking for Shingle Mountain's removal.
Within 1 week, it had grew up over my house, and I started beginning calling then. So I went on and went on. Nobody still called me.
When the mountain continued to grow, Jackson co-founded the group Southern Sector Rising. And because the illegal dumping site is in a predominantly Black and Latinx neighborhood, members of the group called it a symbol of environmental racism and rallied for its removal. But getting rid of the mountain wasn't easy. Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson says the city tried getting Blue Star Recycling to clean up the site. The company declined a request for an interview. It has been in litigation with the city since 2018. And although the city is not responsible for the creation of Shingle Mountain, Mayor Johnson says it's doing something about it now.
No one wanted Shingle Mountain to be there, and I've actually asked the chair of the Environment and Sustainability Committee to find out how that ever happened in the first place, find out what's wrong with our laws that would allow that to ever even occur.
Catherine Holliday, a professor of architecture history at the University of Texas in Arlington, has long studied maps of Dallas. She says the story isn't new.
It's long overdue to really have it be understood that this conversation about South Dallas is really a conversation about neglect and about underinvestment and about a series of choices made across decades that have led to the pairing of lower property values with industrial development.
Holliday says historically, environmental protections haven't existed for people living in South Dallas, and that waste sites like Shingle Mountain are often pushed into communities of color. Back in Floral Farms, Garcia lists some of the dreams she had for her community, dreams that have yet to come true.
Componer las calles, hacer un parque, no tenemos una tienda aquí cerquitas.
Better streets, a neighborhood park, and a grocery store nearby. Huge bulldozers hired by the city of Dallas are now scooping piles of shingles into trucks, the first step in demolishing the mountain. Trucks haul the shingles down the street to the city landfill. Dallas city officials expect the teardown of Shingle Mountain will be completed by March. Longtime Floral Farms resident and local advocate Marcia Jackson says she's cautiously optimistic.
We can't get excited until it's all gone. Just think out of almost 3 years and we have been excited and thinking that this is going to happen before, and it hasn't happened at all. And once that property is completely clean over there, next time you come back out here, you'll probably see tears all down our face.
It's not clear what will happen to the Shingle Mountain site once the waste is removed. Meanwhile, Jackson and her neighbors in the tight-knit Floral Farms community are counting the days. For Here and Now, I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.